Welcome to Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
Hey, everybody. It's almost Oscar night. And as is the tradition around these parts, we're dedicating this podcast to the 85th Annual Academy Awards. We're going to be discussing the 9 Best Picture nominees, speculating as to whether Seth MacFarlane will make a good host, and we'll be attempting to predict the winners in all the major categories. Will Life of Pi sink or swim? Will a Tarantino film finally win Best Picture? And just what does Amour have to do with Poland in 1968? The answers to these questions and more coming up right after these messages. The Back Row has a PayPal account, and we're accepting donations. If you feel like throwing some of your hard-earned dollars our way, you can do so at The Back Row. Just go to the-back-row.com and click the donate button in the right column. If you donate, you can choose a movie for us to review and even specify which of us gets to review it. Doesn't that sound like fun? So send us your pennies, now obsolete in Canada, and we'll review your favorite Oscar-nominated movie of any year. Shouts from the Back Row is available through iTunes. If you search the iTunes store for the Back Row podcasts, you can subscribe to our feed, which will not only get you your weekly dose of media culture from us, but also Tom Lando's all-original audiobook podcast series Oathbreakers, and back episodes of our heavy metal podcast, Drop D Revolution, and our surreality podcast, The Tom Lando Files. Tell your friends and subscribe today. We'd like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, why don't you start us off? What have you been up to?
Other than catching up with a bunch of the Oscar films, I actually did have some time to watch a couple of other movies, which I was kind of excited about. I watched Butter, which is a movie that came out a couple of years ago, and it's a story about this couple, and the guy has won a butter carving competition like for the past 15 years in Iowa, and the judging people come to and say you should probably step down this year to get to give someone else another chance. So what happens is his wife takes over and tries to enter the contest to win, so their family name doesn't go down in flames. And what also ends up happening is her name's Destiny, and she's a little 10-year-old girl, and she enters the competition, and it's just about the two of them facing off to win the butter championship. Now, this movie is a satire of the 2008 Democratic candidacy, the presidential primary, I'm sorry, between Obama and Hillary. And, like, with that in mind, like, the parallels are obvious, but the movie – I'm serious. I know. It sounds like
– With that in mind, the parallels are obvious. I would never have guessed. No way, no how.
But when you think about it and you look at the film, it's really obvious. Like, the parallels are like Jennifer Garner is the wife of Ty Burrell, and Ty Burrell is the guy who wins all the butter competitions, and they are very clearly Bill and Hillary. And Destiny is obviously Obama. But it's a really, really neat movie. Like, even outside of that, without the satire, the film actually holds together really well. Destiny is adopted by Rob Corddry and Alicia Silverstone, who are a couple. And Rob Corddry is excellent in this movie. I think he's perfect. Hugh Jackman has a cameo role in it too, and it's actually just a good movie. But with the satire, it gets really neat. It's an excellent, excellent movie, and I really recommend it. I think it's great.
I always found the plot synopsis for this movie it just seemed so sort of oddball, a very odd choice for a plot of a rom-com. And now to hear on top of that it's this political satire.
Yeah, and it's good. It's really good. Like, I really enjoyed this movie. Like, it's a 4 out of 5. Like, I really liked
it.
So, like, I had a really good time watching it. I thought it was really funny, but that added depth just, I think, brings a lot more to it. Olivia Wilde's in it, and she plays this stripper, and she is fucking hilarious.
You can color me surprised, certainly.
Yeah. It's honestly worth a watch. It really is. And I would love to hear your guys' opinions on it. Robin, have you seen this?
I had honestly completely forgotten about this film until you brought it up, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember seeing a trailer for it a long time ago, but I am pleasantly surprised to hear that you liked it quite a bit.
I really enjoyed it, and like I said, highly recommended, but it's a cute movie, and there's a lot more going on underneath it, I feel, so it's very good. The other movie I watched, which I'm actually amazed I have never seen before, is Wet Hot American Summer. Yeah, which I have never seen, and like...
Neither have I!
Oh, yes! How many films is that? Like, I think there's 4 or 5 films that I think Gil and I have seen that you haven't, Robin, so I think that's kind of
the podcast over the years has certainly been a journey of discovery, finding the handful of films that Robin has never seen.
Yeah.
Got a running tally now.
I like this movie because I like Janine Garofalo and I really like David Hyde Pierce. And it's just such a goofy, funny movie. And a lot of people are in this movie, like Molly Shannon's in it, Paul Rudd, Elizabeth Banks, Brad Cooper, Amy Poehler, like the list goes on and on and on of the people that are in this film.
That's right. I forgot Bradley Cooper's in this, huh?
My favorite person in this entire movie is Christopher Meloni, plays the camp cook who's a Vietnam vet. And at one point, there's a can of mixed fruit that starts talking to him, and the can is voiced by H. John Benjamin, who does the voice of Archer and Bob on Bob's Burgers. And it's probably like the funniest 30 seconds in the whole movie, but it's worth a watch if you want something kind of dumb and stupid. There's some excellent Paul Rudd lines. My favorite being, "You taste like a burger. I don't like you anymore." But there's a really good montage sequence where a bunch of the campers.
I know immediately the one you're talking about.
Yeah. And so they jump off the pickup truck and they're running into town, and you see them like eating McDonald's burgers, and like they buy some beer, and like a bunch of them have a cigarette, and then you see them smoking pot, and then you see them buy heroin, and then they beat up an old woman and steal money out of her purse, and then they're all like crack addicts, and then they come back to camp, and it's like, wow, there sure is a lot of you can do in town in an hour. It's great. It's a goofy movie. It's like a 3 out of 5 for me. It was entertaining enough, and I like the ensemble cast. David Hyde Pierce gives it a point in of itself.
Have you seen any of David Wayne's other films?
Don't think so, actually. Hang on, give me one second. I don't know if I have
like Role Models or Wanderlust.
No. He voiced the warden in Super Jail.
Yeah, he did.
Awesome. Sorry, give me one second. For directing? No, I actually haven't.
I think you'd probably really dig Wanderlust if you enjoyed Wet Hot. I mean, you probably really like Role Models as well. I think they're both really funny films. And Wanderlust was actually a real surprise for me. It was only last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real surprise for me. I didn't expect much of it, but I actually ended up really enjoying it.
Awesome. Other than that, that's all I've been up to. I started reading The Feast of Crows because I never read the fourth book of the Song of Ice and Fire series. I'm just getting into it now because I'm getting much back into the series with a bunch of new trailers that have come out on the net. I'm super excited for it in March. Also, Bob's Burgers this week has probably one of the funniest gags in the entire show, and it involves a safety song that Bob sings with his kids. It's the best thing I've ever seen. I'm not going to spoil it. Like, you'll need to go and find it for yourself, but it's well worth it. Californication kind of dragged this week. I was a little upset about that, but that's okay. It always picks up. Now, I am going to plug one more thing in here because I need everyone on Earth to see this video. For a new ad campaign, Lincoln, the car dealership, has been putting out a bunch of, like, weird little musical things. And one of them is they got a hold of an old David Bowie song, Sound and Vision, from one of his Berlin albums. It's a really minimalist song. There's not a whole lot going on. There's like, Bowie actually doesn't start singing till about halfway through. It's only 3 minutes, and it's pretty. Like, it's a nice little song. Lincoln gave it to Beck and said, what can you do with this? So Beck scored it with a 167-person orchestra, split the song into all its individual parts, and then played them all simultaneously and then separately. It's the most amazing thing I've ever heard through my ears. If you look up Beck Sound and Vision on YouTube, you'll find it. And it's the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my life. And I highly recommend you guys hear about it. I'll post it, I'll post it tomorrow on TBR. And, it's out of this world, guys. I highly recommend it. And other than that, that is all I've been up to. What have you guys been up to?
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I went to see Side Effects, the latest film from Steven Soderbergh, and I liked this film quite a bit. It's kind of funny how the film, it starts off like as kind of this downbeat like drama about depression. It's almost like a very dark, a darker version of Silver Linings Playbook. So it kind of feels like a slog at first, the first half hour, 45 minutes, but then a big surprise happens in it, and it actually, I remember when I saw it in the theater, it actually made the audience collectively gasp because it was so unexpected, and then it becomes a psychological thriller and a really good one. It's been described as an old school Hitchcockian style thriller, and that description would be very apt for it. It's got a lot of great surprises and twists and turns, and it's the kind of old school thriller that I love, where it's like there are just so many little details the first time around that you don't notice, but they wind up paying off later on. Like once they start unraveling the plot, they'll like flash back to an earlier scene and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't notice that, but it plays so well into the plot as well. And, kept me pretty hooked to it from to the very end. I was pleasantly surprised by how much I like this. It's very well acted as well. Rooney Mara is terrific in the lead role. It's funny to read that apparently Blake Lively was the original casting choice for this role and before she was replaced, and obviously that turned out to be a good idea considering how bad she was in the movie Savages. Rooney Mara is just so much better in this type of role, and Jude Law is also very good in the lead role as well, and Channing Tatum is also quite solid in it as well. I gotta admit, the guy has been growing on me this past year.
It's all Soderbergh's doing.
Exactly, yeah, because I haven't seen Magic Mike yet, but I heard he's also good in that as well. And of course, I liked him a lot in 21 Jump Street. So Soderbergh has given this guy like a lot of credibility, what can I say? So yeah, I'd give a big thumbs up to this as well. Apparently, Steven Soderbergh has said this will be his last film. He's been contemplating retiring from directing to go into painting or something full time, but if this is his last film, it was a very good one to go out on. I highly recommend it.
It makes me so so sad to hear that he's apparently going to retire. I still haven't seen Side Effects, but I have been hearing just these rave reviews about it. I really need to see it now, and if it's anywhere near as good as all these reviews have made it out to be, then it's going to be just the spectacular film. Hitchcock's name really is being tossed around a lot with it. And, I can't wait to see it. But, I've been sort of off and on about, Steven Soderbergh over the course of his career. Like, I really like some of his stuff and some of his other stuff I'm not so keen on. I've never counted him among my favorite directors, but over the past, like, few years, I still haven't seen Magic Mike either, but I actually really liked Haywire, much more than I expected to. And it sounds like this is going to be another home run for Soderbergh. And I don't know, I'm kind of mad that he's going to retire, supposedly, because it's like, just now when I'm really starting to get into him, that's it. No more. Aw.
Yeah, I agree. I've liked that. I liked Haywire as well, and I also liked Contagion. Like, he's had a few misses over the course of his career, but his latest filmography has been some of his best stuff. It's kind of a shame that his last film wasn't something like Full Frontal, which is terrible, so you wouldn't feel so bad if you retired. But in a case like this, when he goes out on top, it's a good thing, but it's almost bittersweet thinking that this is the last you'll ever see of him. But definitely a solid effort from him, and he's had one hell of a career.
I've always really wanted to, I mean, I guess he sort of did it with the Oceans franchise, but I've always really wanted to see him sort of take on more mainstream properties, like, you know, do a superhero movie or something, really pander to the blockbuster crowd. I guess the Oceans trilogy is sort of the closest that we'll get to that, but I always wanted to see more stuff like that from him.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he'll just feel compelled to come out of retirement and do a superhero movie. That would be quite interesting. And on the other side of the spectrum, I saw another thriller that is not so good on the complete polar opposite of Side Effects, and that's Alex Cross, which has been nominated for a few Razzies, so I've heard, so that's appropriate for this podcast as well. I gotta admit, I really don't know much at all about Tyler Perry. I have never seen any of his Madea films, and I think the only thing I've ever seen him in is his cameo in the Star Trek film. And on the basis of this film, he is just not a very good dramatic actor at all. I had heard that Idris Elba was originally going to be cast as Alex Cross, and I think that would have been a perfect casting choice, but apparently he was replaced by Tyler Perry because they thought he would draw more box office, but he is just so badly miscast in this because he has to do like a lot of serious, heavy dramatic scenes, and he's just not up to it at all. He's just very wooden and really pales in comparison to Morgan Freeman in the role, but overall, it probably wouldn't have mattered who you cast in the role because the film itself is just a huge colossal mess. Like I joked that it's probably as funny as the Madea films technically because it's got tons of unintentional laughs in it. Especially Matthew Fox is the villain, this like assassin called Picasso. Like he has the most ridiculous introductory scene where he walks into like a UFC event and then just voluntarily goes into the cage and then kicks some guy's ass, and then it turns out it's all an elaborate plot so that this rich woman will hit on him and take him home so he can kill her and stuff. It's got this really ridiculous assassination plot that just does not hold together on when you're watching it. And surprisingly, the film is really badly directed. It's directed by Rob Cohen, who I know is not a good artist, but he knows how to make good action scenes, but in this, the action scenes are just sloppily, like, put together and stuff, and there's this climactic fight scene on the roof of a theater that is just got so much shaky camera that even watching it at home, I almost got nauseous for it. I noticed the film is only rated PG-13, so I think maybe considering that this is covering some dark material that because maybe it was originally filmed as an R-rated movie and they had to cut it down and trim it, and that's why it's so sloppy. But, like, I really couldn't believe this was PG-13 because there are a lot of sloppy action scenes where you have a feeling that some gore or heavy violence in it was in there and was cut. One of the funniest moments in the film, though, is later on where Alex Cross approaches this character played by Giancarlo Esposito, who plays Gus Fring on Breaking Bad. And apparently he's this big crime boss. They don't give an introduction to him at all. It's just kind of a random cameo. And what's funny is Cross goes up to him and he says, "I'm looking for a chemist." And all I could think is, oh, if we're going to do a crossover with Breaking Bad and he's looking for Walter White, then this movie will instantly become awesome. But unfortunately, it didn't. And Giancarlo Esposito is in the movie for no reason whatsoever. But
the only thing that could have saved it.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, that if Heisenberg shows up, then this movie will redeem itself. But no, it just becomes a generic action film. So what more can I say? This is a big thumbs down and one of the worst movies of the year and deserves its Razzie nominations. And on the basis of it, I'm not really compelled to go out and check any more Tyler Perry films.
I gotta ask, Robin, why did you watch it?
You know me, I like to watch bad movies out of curiosity. Like, I knew it would be bad, and I realized, like, when we were doing, like, our Year in Review podcast, that I couldn't think of that many bad films that I'd seen in 2012, so I almost thought to myself, well, maybe I'll check some more of them out, and like I said, I got a lot of laughs out of this movie. It is, like, really unintentionally funny because of how sloppy and bad it is. So, if you're a bad movie fan, I guess you could check it out. But otherwise, don't bother.
Seems like prime material for a riff track.
It would be, yes. I was already thinking of a lot of riffs while watching it.
Yeah, I didn't watch this one. I'm probably never going to watch this one. And I must admit to being somewhat perplexed by the idea of continuing the Alex Cross franchise. Like, I mean, I don't know how successful Kiss the Girls was back in the day. What was it? It was like 1997, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, I think it was a modest hit, but Along Came a Spider was very mediocre, and it's like, I guess, I know the novels are popular, but it was the world of cinema really clamoring the return of Alex Cross.
Okay, I don't know why the books are so popular. James Patterson writes them, and he puts out about four books a month. It's goddamn ridiculous. The man, it just glut writes. It's terrible. Like, I've tried reading them, too, and they're just, ugh. God, they're not very good. So when the source material's bad, like, what are you going to do, you know?
I actually read a review from someone who said that he read one of the Alex Cross novels, and there was an entire chapter devoted to Alex Cross stopping at a red light. So
stopping at a red light?
Apparently, yeah, I guess he was writing his psychological thoughts or something. I don't know.
Oh my
the chapters are really short. So,
have you been up to anything else?
No, that's about it.
So I've been up to a fair amount. Let's see. On the comics front, finished several Scott Snyder and Kyle Higgins runs of Batman comics, including The Gates of Gotham, which is this terrific steampunk Batman five-issue run. It's really cool because it's all about going back to Batman has to investigate something that has its roots way back in the founding of Gotham City, and so you get to see I think it's the four famous families of Gotham. I wish I could remember them all. I think it's like the Canes, the Cobblepots, the Waynes, and someone else. You get to get all these really cool sort of flashback scenes to when Gotham is just this small place and it's being designed by these families that would come to define it. And, it flashes between the past and the modern day where these acts of terrorism seem to be threatening Bruce Wayne, not Batman, Bruce Wayne. Namely, the bridges leading out of Gotham are being blown up one by one, and each of the bridges is named after one of the founding families of Gotham City. And it's just a really great intrigue, terrific five-issue story. It's not overlong or bloated, nothing, but at the same time, nothing is wasted. Really, really good stuff. I highly recommend it. And I'm really late to the game on this one. If we have any comic book fan listeners, they're going to be shouting at me for taking so long to getting around to reading Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. Boy, what an awesome comic. It's such an interesting story. TK, have you read The Dark Knight Returns?
Who wrote that, Miller?
Miller.
Yeah, I have. Actually, I went through a binge where there was a quiet time in the bookstore I work in. I went and I browsed through a bunch of the graphic novels I just haven't read yet. No, it's excellent. I read that, and I read Moore's Batman books, and I started reading the new 52 stuff where they rebooted the DC franchise. Holy fuck, is that ever good.
All the new Batman stuff from the new 52 is absolutely terrific.
And you know what's surprisingly good? The Aquaman stuff.
So I hear
it's actually really good, like to the point where I might seriously reading it because I really enjoyed the first couple issues I read. They're fantastic.
That's so great.
To answer your question, yes, I have read Frank Miller's Batman. It is wonderful.
I finally got around to reading it. It's been a long time coming, very late to the game, but it's terrific. It really is it's like Sin City meets Batman in a nutshell. I really like the Carrie Kelly depiction of Robin. Robin as a young girl, you know, it makes a lot of sense, and I'm surprised that they never tried to do anything quite like that with any movie version. I really like as well in the story how this rivalry between Superman and Batman starts because Superman is now a government agent, and he's told by the president, by Ronald Reagan, in fact, to take out Batman because Batman is just causing all this upheaval in Gotham City, and it all builds up to that fight that all the fanboys have always wanted to see. Who would win in a fight between Bruce Wayne and Batman? Or Bruce Wayne, Batman and Superman, rather. Really, really terrific stuff. Highly recommend it. And you may be asking, why now? Why after so long have I just now gotten around to reading The Dark Knight Returns? In truth, it's because I really want to watch the new two-part animated movie of The Dark Knight Returns, which I hear is really faithful. It's overseen by Bruce Timm, who was one of the founders, the creators of Batman the Animated Series. And Batman is voiced by Peter Weller in it. So I'm just excited for that all around. I hear it's really terrific. On the movie front, I actually watched this a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't mention on our last episode. I watched Gangster Squad. TK, have you seen Gangster Squad yet?
Not yet.
Look at this. It was one of your most anticipated movies of this year, and you're the last one to the game. I share a lot of the similar opinions that Robin has, and I won't even stay on this for too long. It's flashy. It's very flashy, very stylishly put together, but ultimately I felt like it was kind of flat. It definitely wanted to be the next Untouchables, but I didn't feel like any of the characters got enough time for it to really become the new Untouchables. Ryan Gosling does a fine job in his role, and he looks great in all the outfits that they have him wear. Robert Patrick's character, his is sort of a stereotype, but he's still a character, at least. But Josh Brolin's character, even as the leader of the gangster squad, he really isn't given a lot to do. His character doesn't have a lot of character. And what's more, he just doesn't seem like he's very competent. I say that because even though, for example, his wife disapproves of him heading up this new gangster squad, she picks out basically every member by going through all the records. It's almost like she would make a better gangster squad leader than he would. And finally, the climactic showdown between Josh Brolin and Sean Penn. It's just kind of laughable, I'm afraid.
Does it turn into a boxing match?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, I figured.
Yeah, they box, Sean Penn crashes his car, and then they get out and have a fist fight. And the whole time I was just sort of rolling my eyes going like, why would you even bother doing this? Like, the whole point of Gangster Squad is just to kill the gangsters. Why even bother playing it out like that? Just shoot the guy. I kept on feeling like, oh, come on, just kill him. I will say, though, that the few opening moments of the movie had me really hopeful that it would be something more. There are a few especially memorable bits of gore and action. I'm thinking in particular of a moment where a gangster gets his hand cut off by a moving elevator. That stuff, initially, I was like, whoa, maybe there is something to this. I certainly didn't expect it to be so in your face with the blood and the violence, but it very quickly devolved. I don't know, it's not a bad movie, but it's certainly not a great movie. And if you're looking for some really stylish gangstery action, just go watch Boardwalk Empire. Sorry to say it, TK.
It's okay.
Rush out to see it.
Yeah, really. This is going to be the next Cowboys and Aliens. Have you still haven't seen Cowboys and Aliens, have you?
Oh, me? No.
And finally, The Walking Dead has shambled back onto our TVs. And I got to talk about it. Guys, this was a really poorly done episode. I don't know if this is like marking the beginning of a trend, if we're going to see another decline, but this is yet another episode of The Walking Dead where I felt like there was a lot of artificial conflict. And I'm going to spoil a couple of minor points here. For example, at the end of season 3, episode 8, Therese and some of his allies have arrived at the prison, and they're taken in, but they're being kept cordoned off from the others, and it's also that Rick and company have time to sort of decide whether they want to let these people stay with their group or not. Now, it's really obvious, just from the amount of screen time these new characters are getting, that they're going to end up staying with the group. It's really quite obvious, to me anyway. I suppose it doesn't help that Therese is also a character from the comics who becomes a regular part of the group. So I already know they're just going to join up. But this episode really dawdles around, creating this false sense of tension, like maybe they're not going to become part of the group, when there's really very little reason to suspect otherwise. Rick gets angry at Michonne because he didn't... It's not even really clear why he gets angry at Michonne. He finds out that she knew Andrea before they met up, and that angers him for some reason. But it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so they're in conflict, but they're going to make up, and it'll be fine. And of course, as was teased at the end of season 3, episode 8, Merle and Daryl have finally been reunited, after like 3 seasons of waiting, 2.5 seasons of waiting. It's really not the most climactic thing in the world. I'm not gonna lie. It was kind of lackluster in its execution. I still have hope that this show will manage to get back up on its feet and get back to the quality it was showing at the beginning of this season. But, you know, I've been burned by The Walking Dead so many times that I really wouldn't be surprised if this was yet another decline and that was just an anomaly when it got really good. Apparently, Greg Mazera, the new showrunner who replaced Frank Darabont, he's left now. They're going to have to find another showrunner. And at this point, I'm starting to feel like maybe the big twist will be that the TV show was The Walking Dead the whole time. Have any of you guys caught up with The Walking Dead, seen the new episode?
Not yet. I'll probably be watching it like tomorrow or something, but I'm disappointed to hear that considering that it set like a record for ratings and then they pay it off with a lackluster episode.
You know, it may snap back, but for example, Andrea, who is really not my favorite character on the show at all. She's just so annoying and makes a lot of really dumb decisions. She is given the task of like delivering this inspirational speech to the people of Woodbury, and she does not sell it in the slightest. It is just lame. It was actually just recently announced that Lori Holden and the woman who plays Michonne are both coming to the Ottawa Comic Con, so maybe I'll go to her panel and give her a piece of my mind. and that's about all I've been up to. Oscar night. Hey everybody. Yes, it's Oscar night. Let's talk about the 85th Annual Academy Awards. Guys, you know, when we started this podcast, I was in a place where I was never really enthusiastic about the Academy Awards. They were fun, but they were more of a formality and, you know, they always snubbed the people that I really enjoyed, et cetera, et cetera. But since we started the podcast, I actually find myself getting more and more excited every year for the Oscars, just so we can have our discussion and really talk about the films that have been selected for the Best Picture category and, you know, what that says about our culture and what that says about the film trends and whether or not they deserve it. It's always just so much fun to discuss that now I really look forward to them, even if I don't agree with many of their choices. So, guys, what do you think overall about the spread of nominees this year? Do you feel like we've got a better group of nominees in the major categories than we did last year or in previous years?
Yeah, it's tough to decide because there are a couple of films like in the listings this year that I like really like, and there are a couple of films that I really did not like much at all. But I'm thinking of movies that kind of were not nominated, and it's like I can't think of too many that like probably could have gotten Best Picture slots. Like I'm thinking of some of my other favorite films of the year, like Skyfall and The Dark Knight Rises. And those are just not the type of films that normally get like Best Picture nominations. So I guess I'd say overall I'm satisfied, even though there are a couple of films in the Best Picture category that I was not a fan of at all.
Yeah, I feel very similarly. This year was a real year for like blockbuster films and genre films. And the Academy generally doesn't really favor those kinds of movies. So it's no surprise that they didn't get nominated. But as far as the real prestige pictures, I'd say the Academy has certainly covered all of them, including some surprises, too. I'll definitely be talking about that as we get into our discussion of the Best Picture nominees. TK, do you find that the spread of Best Picture nominees or all nominees this year are better than in previous years, or anything stand out?
I don't want to say they're better. It's kind of a hard thing to do, like compare them year to year. I'm trying to figure out like what's a better selection of films that are from the year. I'm with Robin. There's a couple films in here that I really think should be here, and there's a couple of films that I really do not think should be here. and that's all there is to it, I guess. It's an interesting choice, but there's nothing to me in this that really jumps. That's what I feel. I feel like it's kind of a, like, there are some good films in here. Please don't get me wrong. But, like, there's none of them that I'm super excited about.
They're all quite safe, aren't they?
Yeah.
You just wish Lockout had been nominated.
Fuck yeah, I do. That would have been awesome. Best action-adventure movie that's a ripoff of Escape from L.A. and set in space. Come on.
I like how you said Escape from L.A. and not Escape from New York.
Yeah, yeah, right. Sorry. Have I ever admitted I have never seen Escape from New York? I've seen Escape from L.A., but not New York.
Well, you know what? That means you've seen Escape from New York, but with worse special effects.
Oh, okay.
They're really basically the same movie.
Yeah.
What do you guys, are you guys looking forward to the ceremony this year? What do you think of the choice of Seth MacFarlane as a host?
That is definitely interesting. Like, I never thought in a million years the Academy would get somebody like that. Someone who, if he's prone, might try to do something controversial or off color. Cause Seth MacFarlane always struck me as the type of guy who just would snub the Oscars on general principle, who would think that they're just a load of crap. So I was kind of surprised that he even accepted to begin with. But it's definitely not going to be boring. I'm looking forward to see what he comes up with.
Yeah, you know, it. On the one hand, it is a sort of surprising choice. But on the other hand, I actually wasn't all that surprised when they announced it, just because if you look at something like Family Guy, you can tell that, much like maybe animators like Trey Parker and Matt Stone, Seth MacFarlane clearly loves, like, Broadway shows and musicals and sort of, like, big gala events and that, all that. I mean, look at even the opening theme song of Family Guy. It almost plays like an Oscar musical number, like the kind of thing that Billy Crystal would put on.
It's a homage to All in the Family.
It is. It is, yeah. Indeed. But my point is that this really didn't seem outside of Seth MacFarlane's wheelhouse to me when they announced it. But I don't know. I just don't know. Especially considering his most recent film is Ted, which was horribly vulgar and filthy. Really funny, don't get me wrong. But I mean, and heck, it's even nominated for what, Best Original Song? It is surprising to see the Academy acknowledging MacFarlane's comedic talents. Part of me does wonder if they're just doing it to create a bit of mass appeal and try to get in, you know, people who like Family Guy and stuff like that. TK, do you think he's going to do an okay job?
I hope he sings.
Oh, I guarantee he's going to sing. Yeah, he's going to sing.
I'm kind of excited for this. Like, I haven't been. I really started watching the Oscars when Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin co-hosted, and out of the 3 years I've seen since then, they've been my favorite hosts. So I'm interested to see where MacFarlane's going to fall in the last four, because, like, as we've discussed, I think previously, Franco and Hathaway were disasters, and Crystal was good, but not nearly as good as I imagine he used to be. So I'm kind of excited to see where he balances with all this. And, like, I like MacFarlane. I'm kind of excited to see what he's going to do and how he's going to pull it off and how he's going to present. I'm super pumped for it. I'm really excited. And I am actually super excited that the entire cast of the Avengers are going to be presenting awards. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, that'll be pretty terrific. Yeah, you know, I've never – if there is a reason that I hesitate to get totally enthused about MacFarlane, it's just because I've never seen him host anything before. With previous years, I mean, that's why I was skeptical about James Franco and Anne Hathaway as well. But, you know, you look at someone like Jon Stewart or someone like Chris Rock, you know, who's experienced with doing stand-up comedy, and, of course, Billy Crystal as well. These are all people who really know how to command an audience. And I've actually, like, I've heard Seth MacFarlane more times than I've even seen him in anything. So I guess it does remain to be seen. Can he handle these hosting duties?
I've seen him give whenever the writer's strike was going on. I saw him give a bunch of speeches to the Writers Guild, and he was excellent. Actually, he's a very good orator, and I'm kind of pumped to see that. And he still makes it really funny. My favorite line ever is, "And if we make it through this strike, I will personally sleep with each and every one of you, but no butt stuff." Okay, there can be butt stuff. I think it's going to be a neat opportunity for us to see a more public side of Seth that we don't see a whole lot of. I'm really looking forward to that.
Are there any other aspects of the ceremony that you guys are looking forward to? Do you think there? Do you predict any shenanigans?
Nothing that I can think of, no. This isn't like the year when everyone wondered if Banksy was going to show up and do something crazy. So, nothing really comes to mind.
All right, then let's get into our discussion of the Best Picture nominees. We got a lot to get through since there are 9 of them. Let's tackle this in reverse alphabetical order. So let's start with Zero Dark Thirty, since this is the most recent film of the nominees that you've seen, right, TK?
Yeah, that's right.
So what are your thoughts, TK, on Zero Dark Thirty?
Really enjoy Zero Dark Thirty. It's probably in my top 3 for this. I really, really liked it. I did have one problem. The movie was really well put together. The characters are really good. I really like the raid scene, which I think you guys have talked about before. Jessica Chasm's character, what was her name? Emma?
Maya.
Okay. I understand why, as a member of the CIA, she would be so driven to find Bin Laden. She seemed way too involved, way too deep into it, and there was no external reason given for that. And I understand, like, the drive to go after him, especially after 9/11, would have been overwhelming. I feel that there was something else there, like more of a personal vendetta that I don't think we saw enough backstory about. That really bothered me. Because she was too driven and single-minded, and it was too much, I felt. And too much with no deep explanation of it. And that was the only sour point that kind of pissed me off about the film.
The film does keep you at arm's length through much of it. I believe it was Vince Mancini of Film Drunk. I think I quoted this when I gave my initial review of Zero Dark Thirty, but Vince Mancini said that he feels like it depicts arguments rather than getting you involved in the arguments. You know, it all feels almost documentarian rather than a fiction.
Oh, that's an excellent way of putting it. But that's the only down point I saw in the film. It's probably a 4 out of 5 film for me. I really, really like this one, guys.
I also quite enjoyed it. I feel like Zero Dark Thirty makes a very good companion piece to Catherine Bigelow's Academy Award-winning film, The Hurt Locker. I did like Jessica Chastain, though I felt like there were a few points where it felt very obvious that these were the big Oscar moments. In fact, I almost expected the words, like, Oscar moment to flash on the screen like they do in Wayne's World. But overall, I did feel like this was a really solid film. And perhaps one of the most interesting things to come out of it was an article I read recently where one of the members of SEAL Team 6, the SEAL who shot Bin Laden himself, he was interviewed and given a private screening of Zero Dark Thirty. And he said that other than, like, sort of Hollywoodizing it a little bit by having, you know, the Marines yell "breach" when they, you know, blow up Bin Laden's door instead of giving a silent gesture like they actually would. It was pretty accurate overall. It seemed like the final analysis was that it was quite accurate, except for a few little sort of bits of Hollywoodized military protocol. But I just find that really interesting. It seems like from all that I've heard that this is very close to the facts. It almost seems like it's close to the facts in a way that most movies based on true stories really aren't. So I do find that very interesting. I don't know how much longevity this will have, but for a film that tackles a subject, a story that is still so fresh in everyone's minds, it does feel like, I think it was just really well done. I do think it was a very well put together movie. And I think it's a shame that, Catherine Bigelow is not going to get a chance to get another Best Director Oscar, because I thought that the direction in in Zero Dark Thirty was really good as well, especially the opening and the handling of 9/11. What did you think of that sequence, DK?
I found the torture to be a little white-knuckling to watch, but it was...
No, I mean specifically the 9/11 bit right at the beginning where it's the black screen with the phone call.
Oh, the voices. It's Catherine trying to tug emotion out of it, really.
Did you find it ham-fisted?
A little bit, yeah.
Ah, okay, yeah. Interesting.
Very Robin? Much so. I did really like the opening scene. The guy that she deals with, I liked him a lot, actually. I really liked that back and forth with the prisoner for a while. That was very well done.
Oh, but so harrowing. Robin, do you have what are your thoughts on Zero Dark Thirty?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely one of my favorites of the nominees. I thought it was really solid as well. I've always been a big Catherine Bigelow fan ever since she directed Near Dark, so I'm so happy to see her getting nominated for Academy Awards every year now, even though she didn't get a Best Director nomination, like you said. Yeah, this is one of those movies where it's hard to get into at first because it isn't really like Hollywood Eyes. It just put you right into there, into the middle of the events, and it just kind of sticks to the facts and doesn't provide a lot of backstory for the characters. But as the movie goes along, you get really invested into like the hunt to find Bin Laden, and it builds up to that terrific climax with the SEAL incursion. But the point about Jessica Chastain's character Maya, I know some people have seen it kind of as a detractor that you don't learn a lot about her, but I thought that was the most fascinating thing about her, and the character like grew on me as the film went along, and that's what I found most fascinating about her is that when I talked about this on one of our previous podcasts, I compared it to revenge movies where after the hero finally gets his revenge, there's nothing left for him to live for. And this is the same type of character where she's so focused on Bin Laden that once the mission is over, what is she going to do? And I really liked that aspect of her character. And I thought Jessica Chastain played it well. But yeah, I like the ambiguity for it. It's one of those movies where you think of it more as it goes along, and the things that bothered you maybe at the beginning become some of the, I think, best elements of the film.
You know, I've got to agree with you that by not sort of giving us the backstory of Maya, the Jessica Chastain character, it made the ending of the film, particularly just that last little bit where she's all alone on that airplane and the pilot says, "You must be someone really important. Where do you want to go?" Which is, of course, just so it's a rather heavy-handed allegory. But the fact that all we've seen of her is this drive to capture Osama bin Laden, by the time it gets to the end, and like you said, Robin, it's like a revenge film where she just doesn't know what to do with herself anymore, and just she starts breaking down. I did find that pretty powerful, and I don't think that would have been as effective if we'd gotten more of Maya. But at the same time, I do feel I would be interested to learn more about this character. Supposedly, she is based on a real person who's having a lot of a really hard time at work, from what I read.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I mean, she is a really fascinating character, and if her real life counterpart is anything like the character of Maya, man. It's pretty amazing to know that people like that are out there and actually doing this work.
I just want to interject. I fucking loved Mark Strong in this movie, mostly because I had no idea he was going to be in it. When he came out of nowhere, I cheered a little.
Yeah, he was really good. And Joel Edgerton, for all that he's only in this just briefly, also leaves quite the impression.
Really good, actually. I really enjoyed him. It was kind of full of that, oh, he's in it, and I had no idea. No, I really like that.
The same as the Hurt Locker, really. Have you seen the Hurt Locker, TK?
No, I sadly didn't. Oh, my goodness. Guy Pierce is in that, eh?
You would really love it. It's the same sort of thing where, like, every few scenes, some new actor that you really love will pop in, and you're like, oh, Ralph Fiennes. Well, where did he come from, right?
Cool.
So yeah, I do recommend it, especially if you liked Zero Dark Thirty as much as it sounds like you did.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely check it out, guys.
Do you guys have any other thoughts? I mean, we got a lot of stuff to cover here, but any other thoughts on Zero Dark Thirty? This is sort of our big chance to get out the final thoughts.
I just wanted to briefly mention, I know earlier on, a while back, it was considered one of the big favorites to win, but it's kind of got that controversy attached to it where people are calling for a boycott of the Oscars because they think it glorifies torture. But if you actually watch the movie, you can see it doesn't glorify torture at all, and it shows that it really isn't effective. So I think a lot of those complaints have come from people who never actually watched the movie.
I find that debate very interesting because, I mean, like I said before, it seems like this movie is it's really trying to give a portrayal of the facts. And if the fact is that torture was used to extract information, key critical information in the hunt for bin Laden, then we have to depict that. And, you know, it does raise the question of, is torture effective? Is it something that we should be doing? But I mean, that doesn't, you know, it happens and people do it. And if it happened this way, then I don't think you can call the film pro-torture. It's depicting the actual events. But I do find that debate really interesting. TK, where do you fall on that? Do you think that Zero Dark Thirty is pro-torture? I personally don't think so. I think that Catherine Bigelow is much more apolitical, than that.
No, I think she's just telling a story and just using the tools that were used in the original one. Really, when you get right down to it, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, maybe years from now we'll find out exactly how true the events of this film are. But, I mean, like I said, if they tortured a guy and got a key piece of information that led them to discover the location of bin Laden, then you can't leave that out. You really can't. So moving on, Silver Linings Playbook. Robin, why don't you start us off with your thoughts on this one?
Well, I talked about it a little bit on last week's podcast, and I know you guys had already talked about it beforehand, and I'd say that out of all three of us, that I'm probably the one who likes it best. Like, I thought it was, I talked about how going in, I never really thought of it as like a very unconventional romantic comedy. Like, it covers some pretty serious issues like mental illness and bipolar and depression, but it is quite a fascinating love story between Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, and they're really interesting characters, and I thought seeing them interact was really interesting, and it had a lot of great characters in it. I really liked Robert De Niro giving one of his best performances in years. I probably would feel more enthusiastic about it being nominated for Best Picture, but like we have said before, the dance competition climax really does not work at all. It feels like it belongs in a different movie, and like I said, if they had had this climax in a different movie, like a more conventional comedy, it probably would have worked better, but it really kind of clashes with the rest of the movie because the whole problems with bipolarism and mental illness are kind of cast aside, and it's almost like the problem works itself out, really, which is not how it happens in real life, so I thought it was a bit of a cop-out, but it was a really solid film overall and well done, it's probably doesn't deserve to be Best Picture, but I'm not unhappy to see it there. And I'm really happy that at least the actors in this are getting recognition for their performances. And because pretty much the whole cast got nominations. So I'm really happy to see that.
Yeah. The performances of Silver Linings Playbook are really the strength of that movie for me. I wasn't keen on the film overall, but both Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence did great jobs. And, Bradley Cooper, you know, I've enjoyed him in previous roles, but this is definitely the first time where I felt like, you know, I was taken aback. Wow, you know, he's got some real talent to him, and he can really carry a movie and play a more serious role, a more dramatic role. So that I certainly enjoyed, and I really did like Jennifer Lawrence in this movie as well, and the interplay between her and Bradley Cooper. They do have some pretty good on-screen chemistry. So, I don't know, overall it was quite a good film, but I wasn't totally keen on it. There were a lot of things that I didn't feel quite worked, and I personally don't really see what the big deal about Robert De Niro's performance in this is. I don't know. I know I'm in a minority there, certainly minority amongst the Academy, Yeah, I know, it didn't really jazz me, but you quite liked him, didn't you, Ron?
I did. Like, I would not call this one of his all-time best performances, and I kind of think maybe he got nominated just for the simple reason that he's been in so many bad movies this past decade, that now that he's in a relatively, like, serious movie, that they finally decided to acknowledge his work. But I'm just happy to see him nominated again.
Yeah, I can't wait to see, you know, the next Fockers movie that begins with, you know, Academy Award nominee of 2013, Robert De Niro, or Academy Award winner if he takes it. Yeah, any other thoughts on Silver Linings Playbook?
I liked Silver Linings a lot more than I was expecting to. I was really blown away by the acting. The story itself, I wasn't a huge fan of, but I really liked De Niro, I really liked Cooper. Not a big, huge fan of Jennifer Lawrence.
That's really interesting.
I don't know what it is about her, but I wasn't blown away by her in this movie like everyone else seems to have been. And I wish I've been trying to figure out why, guys, and I'm really sorry, but I can't. I wish I could explain it. I just have a weird feeling when I see her on screen. And the best supporting actress nod is good, but I don't know. I think there's other roles that could have pulled it out a little well. But like I said, really liked De Niro, really liked Cooper just for expanding his range. I thought he was excellent in it.
I was quite surprised to see that Jackie Weaver had gotten the nomination for Best Supporting Actress, just because her role in this is so small, and I mean, obviously Best Supporting Actress, they can put a small role up for a nomination there, but I don't know, I think she says maybe a total of 7 lines throughout the whole movie. I felt like I didn't feel her presence in the film, so the nomination was definitely a surprise for me. Is that the case with you guys?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like, what's funny is that I had completely forgotten that she was nominated last year in that movie Animal Kingdom. So it's kind of like she's kind of gotten the quietest 2 consecutive nominations where, like, nobody really remembers her performances.
A shame, because, you know, she wasn't bad at all. I will say, you know, I think my biggest problem with the movie just stems from the essential event that has to happen for the plot to progress, which is Bradley Cooper leaving the institution where he was being treated for his bipolar disorder. He's checked out by his mom at the beginning, and I never really felt like I understood why. I mean, like, he gets into a fight with her before they even leave the parking lot, and I just kind of felt like, you know, no matter how much I love someone, if I can't even get them out of the parking lot before having this explosion of emotion, maybe it's not time to check them out yet. Even the doctor recommends against it. So I always sort of questioned why that was the case. But I mean, it's the inciting incident that drives the plot forward too. So,
as a side note, Chris Tucker was awesome.
Yeah, holy cow! Who knew that guy could actually like act and do stuff? I never thought I'd say this, but it was pretty good to see him back on screen. Doing a more dramatic performance too. It was very surprising.
He's pretty good when he underplays and isn't going a mile a minute like in Fifth Element in the Rush Hour movies.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad he didn't bust out the annoying Chris Tucker voice.
Yep.
Any other thoughts on Silver Linings Playbook?
Nope.
No, let's move it on then. Lincoln. This is a pretty big one. One of the sort of heavy hitters, a favorite for Oscar wins. Probably one of the most Oscar bait movies in this whole list. I'll give my thoughts on Lincoln because I don't think I've actually talked about it much on the podcast previously, even though I did watch it a few weeks ago. You know, I'm in the minority here, but I did find this film to be very dry. I know that both you guys had said on previous episodes that the acting, which is terrific, is what keeps the film from being a slog, but it was still kind of a slog for me. Here's a good quote. On the back row, I love to post the movie review series, Welcome to the Basement, that's hosted by Matt Sloan and, I can't remember Craig's last name, but the guys from Blame Society Films, where they just review any movies that Matt Sloan hasn't seen. And on a recent episode, they were talking about Lincoln, and Craig had a great line where he said, "I loved this movie, and you will too if you, like me, love legislature." And that's the truth. I did find it very dry. Dry is probably the best word I can use to describe it. And very stuffy. Not just in the fact that it contains a lot of stuffy characters, but also in the fact that because of the sort of bleak realism that Spielberg is portraying, every room in that movie felt stuffy. That it's all very dark and dingy and dusty. And I do realize that that is period accurate, but it makes the film kind of feel drained of color, and in a way, drained of life. I found the most compelling scenes to be like the scene where Lincoln lies down with his boy in front of the fire, just because I finally felt like, oh, there's some warmth to this film. And even in like a literal sense in terms of the warm colors that were on screen. But for a lot of it, I felt like it was very visually bleak. Now, all that being said, Daniel Day-Lewis is friggin' great. He just disappears into the role of Lincoln. And I can't deny that I love seeing all of these curmudgeonly actors turn up looking suitably grimy for the time period. Tommy Lee Jones was a lot of fun. Jackie Earle Haley in his small part. And, I mean, it's always nice to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the screen, so that's cool. I was also surprised I didn't know that Dane DeHaan of Chronicle had a small role in this just at the beginning, but it was good to see him too. So overall, this really isn't my kind of film. It's the kind of biopic that it felt just a little too serious and a little too Oscar baity for my tastes, but I certainly can't deny its strengths. And this is a Steven Spielberg film, so the production values are tremendous. I like this. I liked the construction of this film quite a bit more than War Horse. What did you guys think of Lincoln?
Well, that's a fair enough assessment you had. Like, the moment I saw it, one of my first thoughts was, I have a feeling that some people are not going to like this film at all with all the hype, because it really is a lot of guys sitting around in rooms chatting or sitting around in legislature chatting. But, like, if I had read the screenplay for it before I sat down to watch it, I probably would have been bored of it. But I do think that, like, the quality of the production detail and the acting really kept me glued to the screen. Like, there are sections of this film early on where I started to lose a little patience and get bored, because I thought it was going to be more of a biopic of Lincoln's life, but when I realized it was going to take place over the span of a few days, that it wasn't what I was expecting. But, like, I really got into it, though, and by the time they got to the climax where they finally vote on the bill, like, I was kind of glued to the screen. I thought it got really good by that time, and I was really into it. And like I said, it's because of the quality of the acting, and this is pretty much a great character actor's nirvana, because you'll be watching a scene, and all of a sudden, like, a recognizable character actor will pop up. It's like, oh, there's Bruce McGill. Hey, there's John Hawkes and stuff. So it's kind of like an all-star ensemble of, like, character actors, which kind of held my attention. But they cast them really well, because, like, they're all kind of reciting, like, really dry dialogue, but they do it very well. And Daniel Day-Lewis is so good that, like, you can believe it when he speaks inside a crowded room full of people and everybody just stops what they're doing and stares at him and becomes mesmerized. I think there's even a line where Bruce McGill says, oh God, he's telling a story again. And then sooner or later, like, once he starts talking, everyone stops what they're doing. And that's, I think Daniel Day-Lewis, the casting of him really was the key to this. So yeah, I like this movie. I wouldn't call it my favorite Spielberg movie of all time, but I got into it a lot more than I thought I would. So I am happy to see it get nominated.
I can absolutely agree with you that Daniel Day-Lewis has just the acting chops and the charisma to pull off this role, because he naturally just has this such a commanding presence that to put him in the role of someone who is renowned for being as good a speaker as Lincoln was, that it just makes sense. It really is an inspired choice for casting, and he's going to come up again later when we talk about our predictions, I'm sure. TK, thoughts on Lincoln?
Really enjoyed Lincoln, but like you, Robin, I was pulled in and then pulled out of the film, and that kept happening over the course of it. Lewis was amazing in this film. I really liked Sally Field in it, like Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
You liked Sally Field? You know, I didn't like Sally Field. I really didn't.
I thought she was all right. Like, I think she played the part well.
I felt like she was one of the weak links of the movie.
That's fair. I like James Spader. It actually took me about half of the film to recognize him, which I felt stupid afterwards. I like Tim Blake Nelson. I really like Jared Harris as Grant. I thought that was perfect. That was great casting.
Yeah, that was a really good casting choice.
Stolberg, Jones is excellent at, like, I'm trying to, like, I thought the acting was just out of this world, but Lewis makes this movie. Again, some give and take in terms of attention span, but I really, really liked Lincoln, guys.
It's a very good film, just not my thing. Any final thoughts on Lincoln before we move on? I guess not. So, oh boy, it's time to talk about The Life of Pi. TK, this is one of the few films that you didn't have a chance to see, right?
Yes, I apologize. I did not get a chance to see Life of Pi, so you sadly will not hear my opinion on it.
Now, does the fact that I really bashed it on previous episodes have anything to do with that?
No, honestly not. Like, I still wanted to watch it to kind of settle with it, but I could not find time.
When you were outside of the podcast, you and I were discussing the Oscar movies that we still needed to watch. You told me, oh, I still have to watch Life of Pi, and I'm really not looking forward to it. And that made me realize that, you know, maybe I was a bit hard on it. I'll definitely say that I don't think Life of Pi is a great movie. I don't think that I feel like it is, of this selection, it is this year's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. It's very schmaltzy, it's very cloying, it's very obvious in what it's trying to do, obvious in its emotional manipulation. And above all else, it's really safe, you know? It doesn't really take any risks. But all of that being said, I do want to emphasize that the middle hour of Life of Pi is a pretty solid movie. All of the stuff between the sinking of the ship carrying the zoo animals and Pi's return to solid ground, all of the stuff in between that is really, really good. It is very solid filmmaking, and it is compelling to watch. So don't think that Life of Pi is a bad movie. I just don't think it's a great movie. And the fault lies entirely with the framing device, the narrative framing device, that removes literally all tension from the film, because we can see very clearly that Pi survives his ordeal and grows up and has a family. It's made very clear right from the beginning, like, it's not to the point where it's not even a spoiler to say that. The problem there is, of course, you know, when he's stranded on a lifeboat with a man-eating tiger, well, we know he's going to be fine, because the movie has really, like, hammered it home that he's going to be just fine. Don't worry, kids. He's going to be okay. The fault lies entirely with the framing narrative, because also at the end, at the framing narrative, they have this twist ending that we've talked about, and whether or not you think it works, they really don't give the audience the benefit of the doubt. And they have this twist ending, and then they literally spell out exactly what it means. Oh, so you were the tiger, and your mother was the hyena, and your father was the orangutan. Like, they literally spell it out for the audience in no uncertain terms. And that just really bothered me, because it felt to me like Ang Lee, or maybe the studio heads or the producers, somebody thought I was an idiot, because they felt the need to lay it all out for me like that. And that really bothered me. Robin, Life of Pi, did it bug you the same way it bugged me? And do you think it's a bad film? Like, I'd give this, I don't know, maybe 2.5 out of 5, 3 out of 5. Like, it's really not a bad film. It's just not a remarkable film, in my opinion.
Yeah, I have a lot of the same thoughts as you. I don't think it's a bad film, and I think I probably would have liked it better if I had seen it in a theater in 3D, because I heard the 3D is spectacular, particularly during the scenes set at sea. But you're right, the whole framing device just does not work at all. Like, you're revealing right from the outset that Pi is going to survive this ordeal, because you see him as an old man telling the story. And then at the end, for him to tell an alternate version of the story where we don't actually see it. We just hear him sitting around talking about it. And it's like, that might work in the context of a book, but film is show, don't tell. So we don't want to sit and listen to a man tell what really happened supposedly and stuff. So, yeah, they could have cut out like the entire, like, last act of the film altogether. Like, I mean, I don't hate this film at all. I probably would have gotten more into the escapades at sea if I didn't know that Pi was going to survive, because it is really well done and it's visually spectacular, but you know the tiger is not going to eat him. Like, this totally reminds me of the trailer for Castaway when it was released 10 years ago, where they showed you right in the trailer that Tom Hanks got off the island. So it pretty much spoils like the whole movie right there. So I don't understand the logic. I guess the framing device would have worked in the novel, but it doesn't work here on film. So, but even without the framing device, it is kind of a forgettable film overall. And if it hadn't have been nominated for Best Picture, I may not have bothered to watch it. But I will say it's probably not this year's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, because at least the reviews for this one have been pretty good, whereas nobody liked Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. So I will give it credit for that. It's better than that film.
I should make it clear that when I compare it to that film, I mean of the nominees, of the Best Picture nominees, it's the one that felt like the most schmaltzy and the most cloying, in the same way that Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close felt. But The Life of Pi is definitely the superior film. No debate whatsoever on that front. I do feel like if they had just removed that framing narrative, then even the twist moment where he starts telling an alternate version of the events, and we don't see it, we just hear him telling it, if there hadn't been some, if we didn't know that there was this like older version of him telling us this story, that would have been a real eye-opener, I think. Just to have him suddenly start telling this alternate version in such detail, I feel like we as the audience would have suddenly gone like, oh my god, like we've been had. Were we seeing the truth? Or was that all like his own hallucination? It would have immediately posed some questions. But then, of course, they go and ruin it by going like, and this is what it means. Step one, I was the tiger. Step two, you know, like they really shot themselves in the foot there. It's such a shame. But all that being said, TK, I really do encourage you to see it, because I want to hear where you come down in this case. Especially since you and I have been disagreeing on a lot of the nominees, at least in the case of like Jennifer Lawrence. I will be very interested to hear your opinions on Life of Pi.
I'm interested in watching.
Les Miserables. It's been a while since a musical was nominated for Best Picture, hasn't it? What was the last one? Was it Chicago?
Chicago.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. We were all, I think TK, I think of all of us, you liked it the most.
I think so.
What are your thoughts on Les Mis?
I have never, like, I walked into this film blind. No idea of the story. I'd never heard any of the music before at all. Just heard it was good, and Russell Crowe sucked in it. That was literally the only things I knew going into the film. Russell Crowe surprised me. Hugh Jackman I thought was excellent. Hathaway was... I'm starting to find Hathaway a little camera hoggy, and I'm not a huge fan of it. Like I liked her, like she, her part was good, but there's something about her that just doesn't stick with me.
I personally have always been quite lukewarm towards her as an actress. I have a hard time finding her convincing.
Yeah.
And, but that being said, I do feel like in Les Mis, she's really the only, like Hugh Jackman does give it his all, like he's really trying, but she was the only one I actually bought in Les Mis. Her song where she did it all in one take, and she recorded it live. I think that recording is probably the best one on the entire soundtrack, considering they recorded all of the music right there on the set.
Oh no, it was great. What else? I don't know. I really enjoyed the film. Russell Crowe didn't move his arms, which really bothered me. He doesn't. He sings with his arms down by his sides, and it never changes.
Well, neither does his singing. You want to hear every song Russell Crowe sings in this movie? That is every song he sings. When he sustains a note, it's
I enjoyed him, actually, and I like the storyline. I you have to keep in mind, personally, I am obsessed with the French Revolution. I think it's one of the most interesting periods in history, and so anything that has to do with the revolution, I'm a big fan of. So that definitely skews this. I like the failed revolution. I like that. I thought it was cool, and I like the and I think I mentioned this on our podcast last week. Whenever I watched it, like, it's supposed to be a sad movie, and like nothing really got to me, and then the last 5 minutes, I just lost it in the theater. It was really awful, but I really enjoyed this. It hit me a lot harder than I thought it was going to, but I really like Les Mis. I honestly think it's not going to win anything, but we'll get to that later.
I think there's one thing that'll win. Robin, what are your thoughts on Les Miserables?
Yeah, I talked about this last week, but I liked it for nostalgic reasons, because I used to study this a lot back when I was in grade school. Like, we went to see a live production for it, and I would have been really excited if this film had come out like 15, 20 years ago, but now, like, the novelty had kind of wore off. But I did enjoy sitting down to watch it and reliving the songs and reliving the story and the soundtrack and stuff. So it was fun on that level, but overall it was a pretty forgettable musical, because you kind of look at the story, and it might be sacrilegious to say this, but there are quite a few, like, stupid plot holes in this. I should mention that I just turned in my latest article to crack.com about stupid villainous schemes, and the last entry I put on the list is Inspector Javert's plan to go undercover with the students of the revolution. If you break it down, it is the dumbest plan ever, because basically he is the most feared authority figure in Paris, and everyone recognizes him, and he goes undercover wearing a new hat, and he is recognized, like, right away. So there are a lot of really stupid plot elements like that that really don't hold up, but because it's a musical, I think a lot of people are able to put it aside. But I mean, it kept me entertained for 2.5 hours. I thought that Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway came across best. Russell Crowe, like I said, he probably would have been great as Javert in a non musical version, but having him record live really did not help at all. And I enjoyed Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen as the Thénardiers, but they kind of felt like they belonged in a different movie. They literally felt like they wandered over from Sweeney Todd or some, like, Tim Burton song. So even though they were fun in the roles, they didn't really gel with the rest of the film. So what can I say? I mean, I'm glad I saw it, but it's probably not Oscar-worthy, though I could see why the Oscars would like something like this. And I guess what I can say is I probably won't check it out again, and that I would have been more enthused if I had seen this a couple years earlier. But not a bad time overall, I'd say.
You actually touched upon one of the main things that made the movie not work for me. In my initial review on the podcast, I believe I talked about how opera is the kind of thing that works because of the artifice of theater. When people are, you know, because in a theater, you're seated so far back from the actors that you can't see every little expression, you know, every little tick and wrinkle on their face. Having them sing their thoughts, it makes sense. It's like a shorthand so that the people in the nosebleed seats still understand what's going on. And it's an opera, so of course they have to, you know, they sing everything. But in the film version of Les Mis, because there is no artifice, they're trying to do this very realistically, it just didn't work for me. For example, everybody sings to each other when they're even in conversation with another character. They sing their conversation to each other, like every word they sing. And what that means is that when they start singing their inner monologue, for example, after Jean Valjean meets up with Javert, after Valjean has assumed a new identity, Javert leaves, and Valjean has his little inner monologue about, oh my God, does he know who I am, right? except because he was just singing to Javert, and Javert has just left the room, when he starts singing to himself, oh my god, does he know who I am? I'm like, maybe Javert can, like, hear you right outside the door, dude.
So true. Man.
You know? And another good example of having them sing every little thing not working is after Javert goes undercover and he's like, and he says, you know, I can go and spy on the troops for you guys. I know their ranks. Like, I know how to get through and I can go spy on them for you. He just keeps singing it. And all I kept thinking was, so friggin' go, like, go do it. Stop standing there and singing and go and do it. And then, of course, again, I loved Sacha Baron Cohen and Hello Bottom Carter. By the way, you could really tell that every little inspired moment that Sacha Baron Cohen had was probably improv'd by Sacha Baron Cohen. The way he keeps on calling Cosette, like, Colette and the wrong name. I thought that was really funny and quite inspired, but it felt very obvious to me, like, that was Sacha Baron Cohen coming up with that and not Tom Hooper. Did you guys feel the same way about it?
Yes, that's what I thought, that you can kind of tell what's from the original musical and what's a guy improvising.
But I felt like it worked. However, because they couldn't really commit to either being really realistic or being a full-blown, like, artificial-feeling opera, I love the Master of the House number is one of my favorites of all of Les Mis. It's just such a good, like, you know, sort of rousing number that everybody can get into. It's got ba-da-da-da-da, like, it's got a real beat to it. And when everybody joins in, you know, everybody raise a glass. It's such a great moment to get into and to, like, and it's a much-needed moment of levity in the middle of an otherwise extremely depressing story. However, because they were trying to aim for a certain degree of realism, everybody in the Master of the House number in the movie of Les Miserables, they're all acting really drunk. And as a result, I felt like they slurred that number out. They didn't really make it a big, like, rowdy number. It was all like, Master of the House, you know? And that was a real disappointment for me, because I felt like if any number could have really, like, knocked it out of the park, especially with the casting of Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen, it would have been that one, but it felt somewhat overwhelming to me. Am I alone on that one? Did you guys feel that way too?
Yeah, I was kind of figuring, like, that would be a show-stopping number, but it was just kind of average, I thought, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it, but again, like, you guys, just kind of average.
Yep. Such a shame. Any other thoughts on Les Mis?
I'm in the mood now to sing Master of the House. So
yeah, exactly. I think the conclusion we came to after you saw it, Robin, was, maybe even after TK saw it, but if nothing else, this movie will definitely make you want to listen to the soundtrack, a good cast recording of the soundtrack to Les Miserables, because it's an awesome soundtrack. The movie may not be top-notch, but man, the soundtrack is still as good as ever. So I like the way you die, boy. Let's talk a bit about Django Unchained. I was really surprised that this got a nomination for Best Picture. Not because I don't think it deserves it. I love Tarantino. Kill Bill should have gotten a Best Picture nomination in my mind. Like, Inglourious Basterds made sense to me, because Inglourious Basterds was about as close as Tarantino has gotten so far to a real prestige picture. And he did a lot of showing off in Inglourious Basterds of his complete knowledge of film. You know, it's sort of like Basterds was proving to the Academy that, you know, I'm not just some pulpy hack director. I actually know an awful lot about cinema history and how film, film can be used as a weapon, and how it has historically been used as a weapon with, Nazi propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. It made sense that Inglourious Basterds would get nominated for Best Picture. Django Unchained, though, you know, for all that it does tackle the very serious issues of racism and slavery, which seem to be, like, running themes through a few of the films, that were nominated this year, it definitely leans into pulpy genre territory. I mean, there's just such gratuitous violence and so many overtly, you know, over-stylized Tarantino moments. Django Unchained was nominated for Best Picture and features the worst performance from Tarantino in any of his movies. How in the hell did that happen? But I mean, of course I love this film, of course. And at its core, there are those little references. They're even too obscure, I think, for the Academy to have noticed them. But perhaps the best example is Django's blue outfit is based on the famous painting The Blue Boy. The painting The Blue Boy inspired F.W. Murnau's film The Boy in Blue. F.W. Murnau is best known not only for his filmmaking, but for creating what he called the unchained camera technique. So, like, you're playing 6 degrees of separation with film trivia in something like that. And it's yet another, like, reference to the fact that Tarantino really does have this extensive knowledge of film history and is quite the scholar himself. But it's hidden under so many layers of just pulp and blood and hip-hop music that I'm amazed Django has gotten as much acclaim as it has, especially with the way it deals with slavery and racism. Like, this is a lot of fantasy wish fulfillment, but boy, I'm still quite surprised that the Academy acknowledged it. What do you guys think?
Well, I definitely stated it was my favorite film last year, but I too was shocked that I got a nomination for Best Picture. I would love for it to win, but I don't think it will. I'd say, like, out of Quentin Tarantino's films, this is almost, like, the least likely to ever bring home a Best Picture Oscar, though I would love to see it happen. But, yeah, like you said, it has, like, a lot of, like, deep meanings about, like, racism and slavery, but they're not very subtle. So, like, this is first and foremost, like, a great pulpy B-movie and stuff, and it's a terrific one. Like, it was made for people like me, because it has like the obscure references you're talking about. That was one of the joys of watching this movie, is seeing a lot of obscure, like, B-movie actors, like, pop up in small roles and stuff. Like, of course you had Franco Nero, but you had also guys like Tom Savini popping up, and guys like Bruce Dern and Don Stroud in small roles. Some of, like, the guys who starred in Tarantino's favorite movies getting cameos here. But it is just so much fun. Like, I'm really happy that Christoph Waltz was got a Best Supporting Actor nomination again, because even though he was terrific in it, it didn't seem like the type of role that the Academy would acknowledge, because they kind of overlook the performances in B-movies like this, but he was terrific. And I kind of wish DiCaprio had gotten a Academy Award nomination for it as well, but
he was seriously denied, I feel.
It's true. I guess they kind of figured that he's gotten so many other nominations that they wouldn't give it to him in a B-movie, but he is terrific in it as well. And he's almost, I almost felt that Samuel Jackson was just as good in the role of Steven. Like, I was not expecting when I went into it that Steven would kind of turn out to be the biggest villain in the film and be such a major bastard, but he is terrific in it as well. And, yeah, what can I say? I don't know if Tarantino, I hear that he might be afraid it to take home Best Original Screenplay. I kind of would, because I don't think Tarantino has won an award at all except his Best Original Screenplay for Pulp Fiction, and that was like 19 years ago, so I would love to see him go on stage again at the Oscars. But still, like I said, my favorite film of the year. I am surprised to see it nominated for so many Academy Awards. I would like to see it at least win one or two, but it really is unconventional. I mean, it's not even the best Tarantino film. Like I said, even though I loved this film, I still would rank it in the middle amongst Tarantino films. But it seems like the older he gets, maybe the Academy is getting more sympathy towards him, so they're giving him more nominations. And one of these days, I would love to see him finally win a Best Director or Best Picture. But knowing Tarantino, he probably doesn't give a fuck. If he doesn't win, he won't care. Because like you said, his performance in this is basically him saying that he really doesn't give a fuck what anyone else thinks. He's going to give the worst performance possible, but he doesn't care. And that's just the type of filmmaker he is and why we love him.
Yeah, man. It is such an interesting mixed bag of stuff with Django Unchained. You know, you say Tarantino doesn't care, but I don't know. I really love just these little touches, like the idea of Dr. King freeing the slaves, or the idea that Broomhilda von Schaft is according to Tarantino, like, the great-great-great-great-grandmother of John Shaft. That is hilarious. Like, that is just so awesome. Cool. Yeah, I love this movie. Maybe the only way, I mean, we keep saying, TK, you haven't gotten a word in yet, but do you think Django Unchained is going to take home Best Picture?
No, I don't.
The only way that it might is if they give it to Django Unchained as an apology for not giving it to Bastards. I think that's the only way.
I'm sorry. I think Tarantino deserves the Oscar for Bastards. Like, I understand.
Of course he did, but they didn't give it to him.
Of course they
didn't. They might for this one.
No, I'm sorry. If he doesn't get an Oscar for Bastards, he doesn't get an Oscar. That's the movie that should have won him one, and it didn't. So fuck you, Academy, when it comes to Tarantino. Really, I like Django Unchained, guys. I really did. It's not gonna win a Best Picture. Love seeing Waltz in there. Pissed off Caprio got snubbed because he was brilliant. God, what else do you say about this movie? Again, like we talked about Django, endlessly on this podcast before. Yeah. So,
undoubtedly my favorite Jamie Foxx role. I thought he was absolutely terrific, and I really wish that I could have seen this with its original projected cast, because I totally love the cast, but apparently initially it was going to have Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Sid Haig was considered for a role for a long time, Kurt Russell and Kevin Costner were both considered for roles, and once again, Sacha Baron Cohen was apparently going to pop up. And for a small role, as was Lady Gaga in the role of Lara Lee Candy Fitzwillie, Calvin Candy's sister. Like, that would have been amazing, too. It's amazing as is, but boy, I would have loved to have seen that. Also, supposedly there was a role for Michael Kenneth Williams of The Wire, but it was unfortunately cut because he wasn't available to play it. And he would have been terrific. This would have been amazing movie for him. It really would have. On we press to Beasts of the Southern Wild. This was sort of like a surprise for a lot of people, I think, that it got as many nominations as it did, particularly for Best Picture and Best Director, because this is the first film from a first-time filmmaker, Ben Zeitlin, and I wouldn't say it's unheard of for the Academy to give such recognition to such a newcomer to the world of cinema, but it's certainly a rarity, especially to have a film like this appear in so many of the major categories. Robin, what did you think of Beasts of the Southern Wild?
I was just kind of indifferent to it, really. Like, I know this movie has kind of taken the world by storm, and, like, it's getting a lot of praise, and it's almost like the Academy is giving it all these, like, nominations just for a great story. Like, oh, we're giving a first-time director a Best Picture and Best Director nomination, and we're giving a 9-year-old girl a Best Actress nomination, but the film itself, it's impressive. Like, there's a lot of good in it from the director, Ben Zeitlin. I'd like to see him do more films, but I just did not find it involving really at all. Like, it built up a really interesting world to it, but it really did not have a compelling narrative, because it's like people preparing for a storm happens, father dies, looking for biological mother, and then it didn't really work at all when the prehistoric creatures, the Yoroks, actually literally made an appearance near the end of the film. It didn't really work at all, and even though there were some beautifully composed shots, I kind of felt there was way too much shaky cam. It almost felt like, since the director was such an amateur, that when I saw the camera like shaking, I almost wondered, is he doing this intentionally or is he just being sloppy and amateur? And it kind of got distracting after a while. So this was a film I admired more than I enjoyed. It had its moments where I thought, well, there's some good stuff in here, but as an overall film, it just did not tickle my fancy. And I know it's kind of a dark horse choice to win Best Picture, but I kind of hope it doesn't, just because I think it's getting a lot of recognition just because it is kind of a feel-good story of a filmmaker coming out of nowhere to make a good film, rather than it being a great film overall, I think.
Wow, man, like, well put. I think that is a terrific description of my feelings as well towards Beasts of the Southern Wild. a film that I admired but didn't enjoy. Very well put. The shaky cam didn't actually bother me at all, and in fact, I felt like it worked in the film's favor by lending an air of documentary to it. And I really do like the visceral nature. Like, everything about this movie felt very real, and that's probably because this is this first-time director presenting us. You know, he's finding his voice, and he has all of these new actors, these amateur actors, people we haven't seen before. So there's no distraction of celebrity. I thought all of that worked very well, but as I've mentioned previously on the podcast, compared the film to Tideland in a way, in that it portrays this crushing poverty through the eyes of a child, and in doing so, adds this element of romance, and I felt like it was romance that almost just shouldn't have been there. It didn't make me comfortable to watch. To watch it simply because these people are living in this really awful situation, but the way it's portrayed makes it seem really sort of fantastical and wonderful. And who is Ben Zeitlin, like this white dude from what, New York? Who is he to tell us about the turmoil and troubles of impoverished black people living in a Louisiana bayou? Like, what does he even know about this? The play that it was based on didn't even have that plot. Apparently it was about some young white guy in the South. So it's just some very odd choices there. It's so interesting to see Beasts of the Southern Wild placed alongside Django Unchained, because Beasts of the Southern Wild falls victim to this cinematic trope of the exceptional Negro, meaning black character whose only function in the story is to be mystical and wise. And I definitely feel like both Hush Puppy and her father are given these elements of the trope of the exceptional Negro. And the reason I say it's amazing to see this placed alongside Django Unchained is that Django Unchained is taking that very same cinematic trope and turning it completely on its head, to the point where, there is even an exchange where Leonardo DiCaprio's character uses the phrase "the exceptional Negro," and it's very clearly Tarantino again showing off his film scholar merit badges and saying like, "I know what I'm doing here." But I mean, there has been a lot of debate about race and what it means in Beasts of the Southern Wild, but on a purely visual level, I think this movie is really fantastically put together. And it wasn't nominated in the one category that I thought was outstanding. Besides, of course, I really did like Kevin John A. Wallace. She gives a great performance in this. But the category that I felt like it was really snubbed for was Best Original Score. I loved the score for Beasts of the Southern Wild, and I found it a lot more memorable than everything that was nominated. TK, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
This is my least favorite Oscar film.
Oh, okay.
I don't get the hype. I think that her performance is good. I don't think it's Best Actress good. I don't know. Just this film didn't sit well with me when I watched it, and I didn't enjoy it. I wasn't really drawn into the story. I wasn't really drawn into the world. It's just, I don't know. It just wasn't my type of film, guys, and that's just all there is to it.
Do you feel similarly the way Robin and I do, in that it's a film that you can admire but you didn't necessarily enjoy, or did you not even enjoy it on like a purely visual level?
On a visual level, it was nice, but I'm not going to say I was what was the word you used?
Admire.
I'm not going to say I admired the film at all.
Interesting.
This is my extremely loud and incredibly close of this year.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah, I really didn't like it. I don't see the hype. I don't see why it's there. I really don't. And what's it nominated for? Actress, picture, and director? I don't know. I think there's other films that could have been placed there.
There might have been. I do wonder. As always, Academy politics tend to enter into the considerations here, and I really do wonder like how much of this was the Academy being like, oh yeah, great story, first time director. It's also, you know, give out the youngest best actress nomination in the history of the Oscars. Why not? Let's go for the extremes. But I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see how this one performs. Like you said, Robin, it is sort of a dark horse pick for the Best Picture category. Any final thoughts on Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Well, if you're calling it this year's...
Sorry?
This year's extremely loud and incredibly close, but at least the kid in this one is a lot less annoying.
Oh my god, yes. You're so right. So let's move on to Argo. A few weeks back, we just did this sort of blind prediction as to who would take home the Academy Award for Best Picture. Blind in that not all of us had seen all the movies. And Robin, I believe you picked Argo as your choice.
Originally, but it changed as time went on.
Now, we'll get to our predictions in a second, but with all of the events of recent days, I'm beginning to think that this might actually turn out to be the one. Simply because, what was it that it took? Was it a Golden Globe that it won?
I think so, yes.
And, I think it also did quite well at the SAG Awards. It won an AFI Film Award, that's right. So it's been doing quite well. Oh yeah, and BAFTA as well, won a BAFTA Film Award. But it's been doing quite well on the awards circuit, so it'll be very interesting to see how well Argo does at the Oscars, considering it was nominated for Best Picture but not Best Director. And as we've said in the past, those two categories usually go hand in hand when it comes to the winners. So Argo, TK, what are your thoughts on Argo?
I loved Argo. The only flaw I felt in it is that Ben Affleck doesn't emote at all. His face is pretty much exactly the same throughout the whole film. But I really, really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was perfectly detailed at the time. I liked the guy who played the Canadian ambassador. I liked all the guys that played the refugees hiding in his house. I liked everything about this movie. I thought it was excellent. I loved John Goodman, loved Alan Arkin, everything about this movie I really, really enjoyed. I don't have any criticisms of it, I'm afraid. And the fact that it's been tucking away so many awards at the other independent film stuff, I've been very, very happy with. So this is my one of my favorites for this year.
Robin, do you share TK's enthusiasm for Argo?
Oh, definitely, yes. I ranked it as my second favorite film of the year behind Django Unchained, though I think this one has a much better chance of taking home Best Picture than this one. But I talked about this on previous podcasts, but I loved it just because it was a true story that had me on the edge of my seat, where you knew how it was going to turn out, but you were in suspense about a lot of the stuff that was going to happen, and especially during the big climax set at the airport. And it worked well as a thriller and a comedy as well, because the first half of the film, where they're focusing more on making this fake Argo movie, is just so entertaining. Just it made me want to see a real Argo movie actually get made one of these days. But it was really fascinating stuff. And like I said, Ben Affleck is, surprisingly enough, is one of those directors who I look forward to each and every one of his films. He's directed three movies, and he's 3 for 3 so far. They've all been terrific. And even though he doesn't emote in this movie, but I thought he did a decent job in the lead role, and I thought it was one of his better performances, and he had a terrific supporting cast surrounding him. And here's an interesting piece of trivia. Who is the one actor who has appeared in 2 Best Picture nominees this year? Michael Parks, who has small roles in both Argo and Django Unchained. So I think that's a sign that you cast Michael Parks in your movies, and he's a good luck charm.
still sore from him getting snubbed for his role in Red State.
Exactly, yes.
This is a movie that really, by all accounts, by all the criteria that I've laid out about the films that I like over the years of doing this podcast, this is a movie that I really shouldn't fall into the category of me like really liking it. I do really like the films of Ben Affleck as a director. I think he's superb behind the camera, and he should stay behind the camera. It's a true story. It's a drama. It's based around political strife. It's like a period piece, but it's set in like the early 1980s. all of these things, and it is also very clearly sort of an Oscar bait movie, all of these things should add up to me not really liking Argo, because I generally don't like movies that fit that description. However, Argo has something going for it that most movies of this ilk do not, and that is humor. Oh my God, guys, how difficult is it to put just a little bit of humor in your movie? Because for something like Argo, you know, Argo has this amazingly tense opening scene where an embassy is being stormed by a mob. And that is frightening. Like, it is an edge of your seat sequence. And to then, you know, moments later, 15, 20 minutes later, have people saying, Argo, fuck yourself. And we're yucking it up with Alan Arkin and John Goodman. And we're having a script read through where there's a guy in a robot costume. Like, all of that stuff, it really diffuses the tension a bit, but it also makes it feel that much more genuine, because sometimes life is pretty darn funny. And I especially love the bit at the end where, you know, they're so close to freedom, they're so close to getting on their plane, and they get stopped, and you feel like, oh my God, like, this is it for these guys. How are they going to get out of this one? And it's all because just one guy does this whole movie pitch, and he does it so well that he convinces their captors that, oh, well, they must be actually here to scout a movie, because, you know, who would make something like that up on the fly? It works so well, and it's a really tense sequence, and it builds up to a really great catharsis of humor. And boy, did I appreciate that. Like, I do feel like Argo is one of the few Best Picture nominees this year. If not, like, maybe between this and Django Unchained, they're the only ones where I feel like they had a little something of everything. Like, they had moments of extreme tension, they had moments of sadness, they had moments of happiness, and they did have moments of genuine humor. And that really worked for me.
Yes, there are some other Best Picture nominees this year that seriously could have used some humor.
No kidding. I think we're probably going to talk about one in a second. Yeah. any other thoughts, last minute thoughts on Argo?
Argo, fuck yourself. What can Argo, I say? My favorite quote of the year.
Yeah, man, to think that that is like the catchphrase of all of these, Best Picture movies. It's like that. And I Like the Way You Die, Boy, or the two catchphrases to come out of the films. Okay, guys, let's talk about Amour. Now, I actually have a ton of stuff to say about this movie, so I'm going to let you guys go first. TK, did you have a chance to watch Amour?
No, this is one of the films I again, did not have a chance to see, and I apologize for that, guys. I'm sorry.
And Robin, did you see it?
Yes, I did. And what we were saying a second ago about humor and how much it's appreciated, this is a movie that I could have used humor, levity, something joyous, anything to have helped me get through it. It actually took me a couple of viewings to get through the whole thing. This is a film I can admire for how well made it is, because it's very well acted and it's very well shot, but my God, it's depressing as hell. Like, this is a movie that I would probably never bother to check out if I hadn't been compelled to watch all the nominees for Best Picture, because, like it said, this is a movie, it will always get tons of praise, but it's like, can you find a person who could admit to actually enjoying a film like this? Because that's what I find. The most depressing films out there are ones where you have to follow characters dealing with like a debilitating illness and stick with them for like 2 hours and know that they will only gradually get worse and that there will not be catharsis and it's going to lead to a downer ending. And you know that right from the outset, because it opens with like firemen breaking into the apartment to find like the lead character dead on the bed. So you just know it's not going to turn out well. And, what can I say? Like, both Jean-Louis Trintignant or whatever his name is and Manuel Riva, they play their parts really well, but it's almost a case of them playing their parts too well, because they're just so convincing that it's just really hard to watch them just like see this woman get worse and worse and see this husband like almost reach the point where he might want to kill her just to put her out of her pain and stuff. Like, I mean, that it takes a lot of balls to make a movie like that, and I admire them for it, but it's just not good entertainment. And I would probably be, like, not be so harsh on this film, but there are really a lot of self-indulgent scenes in here, like that Michael Haneke films. Like, there's a scene near the end where the character is trying to catch a pigeon that has got loose in his apartment. Like, he has a lot of scenes where he just leaves the camera running for big non-events where there's not a lot going on. It's like, we're going to see him change her bedpan, and we're going to see him change her clothes, and we're going to see him chase a pigeon around. Like, it's really dull, unfortunately, even though it may be well made. It actually put me in the mood to watch Michael Haneke's Funny Games, which is a pretty depressing film in itself, but it's nowhere near as depressing as this one. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on this. This is a film that I would probably never watch if it wasn't nominated for Best Picture, and we'll never watch again. It's pure Academy fodder, where it's well made, well acted, and tugs at your emotions, but it's just not entertaining to watch.
Oh boy, I am so excited to talk about this.
Yes.
And not for the reasons you think, I bet.
Oh, really?
Now, I'm going to preface my review of Amour by saying I may favor genre movies on this podcast. I'm a big nerdy fanboy. I mean, I love Django Unchained. Django Unchained is my favorite film of all these nominees. But I'm not without a little culture. I have a degree in film. And to earn that degree, I had to study the hell out of film history. And I'm sorry if that seems like I'm waving my credentials around, but the point is, what Michael Haneke has done with Amour appealed to the film student in me. The mise-en-scène in this film, it's stunning. The ultra-realistic composition, void of music, filled only with diegetic sound, is daring in this day and age. It's as though Haneke wanted to tell a story using only the most basic tricks of cinema. The long take, the unchained camera that follows someone into another room, dream sequences, clever sound cues as well. The early scene wherein Anne has her episode, and then George leaves the tap running, and we hear it get turned off from the other room. There's a strange kind of palpable tension in those scenes. But whereas Haneke's previous films like Funny Games or Caché is a great film, I don't know, have you seen that one, Robin?
Yes, I had. It was flawed overall, but it did have a lot of stunningly shot scenes in it.
Yeah, exactly. With those kinds of films, with most films that are like rife with tension, there's this build-up of suspense and then this release, some form of catharsis, a scare or a jump or some big thing. There's no catharsis in Amour. Even in that dream sequence where Georges is attacked from behind in the bathroom, no sooner has the catharsis of his scream started than it's immediately diffused by Georges waking up. We get no relief at the end of these moments of tension. And what about that scene where you're made to think that Anne is playing the piano, but then Georges turns off the music on the radio behind him? Those, like, they're just so surprising. They're really very, very interestingly done. I expected this movie to be dull as a spoon, but what I got was a film that I feel was clearly made by a new master of cinema. That's not to say that it's perfect. Far from it. I don't think that this is a perfect film. There are many, many moments where the movie drags. But the performances of Jean-Louis Trintignant, I think it is, and Emmanuel Riva are really compelling. And I think that they actually have the best on-screen chemistry that I've seen all year. You really feel their emotions. And if I had my druthers, I'd probably give Emmanuel Riva the Best Actress Oscar. But more on that later. Now, I posed a question at the beginning of the podcast that you were probably confused by. What does Amour have to do with Poland in 1968? Any ideas? Anyone?
I don't know. Did Emmanuel Riva like star in any big Polish films around that time period or something?
Oh no, but you're getting quite close. So here's where the film student in me comes into play. This is part of why I actually really enjoyed Amour, is because it made me sort of go down the rabbit hole of film history. I was familiar with Emmanuel Riva and Jean-Louis Trintignant from their work in the Three Colors trilogy, in the films Blue and Red, respectively. And as soon as I saw these two actors in Amour, I began thinking of the director of Blue and Red, Krzysztof Kieslowski. Kieslowski belonged to a Polish cinematic movement from the 1970s that was a reaction to the 1968 Polish political crisis. Now, even though Michael Haneke is German, I feel like Amour belongs to that same movement. And here's why. That movement was called the Cinema of Moral Anxiety. I felt like Amour was a prolonged exercise in anxiety. I felt anxious throughout this whole movie, especially considering that they give you the ending at the beginning. She's dead on the bed and the apartment is sealed up. What has happened? And even that question is not fully answered by the film's conclusion, but it lends this air of anxiety to all the proceedings. And boy, I really appreciated that. Like I said, the composition of the frame, the cinematography in this was really quite amazing. Quite unlike what we see in most films today. The movie is a serious bummer, but I mean, it's based on Michael Haneke's life experiences as his aunt suffered a degenerative disease. So I guess I can't really complain about it. All I can say is that I liked this film way more, like way, way more than I expected to. I thought it was going to be really, really dull. And while it is a bit overlong in parts, which is why I don't think it's perfect, and I certainly don't think it's going to win Best Picture, but I ended up like walking away from it feeling enlightened. Like I really felt like I had seen something that I didn't expect to see. After this, though, I really want to see Michael Haneke direct the next Paranormal Activity film.
Oh, yes, that's true.
But I really want to see him do that. I know it's not going to happen. But certainly after seeing him handle tension quite well in Funny Games especially, I know he could make a really good horror movie. And the way that he uses his camera, the way that he frames shots, and his ultra-realistic sensibilities that you see on display in Amour, I think he could actually pull it off quite well, as funny as it is to say. End film geek gushing. Look what he did to me. Look what he did to me.
I probably would have liked to have seen this within the context of a film class. It might actually be interesting to study, though, but just sitting and watching it by yourself alone at home is just kind of so soul-crushing, though.
Yeah, I started studying this film as it was going on. I got out the iPad, and I was like,
oh, okay.
And I was like, Kieslowski, there's got to be a connection to Kieslowski besides the actors, because this feels like it belongs alongside the films of Krzysztof Kieslowski. But man, yeah. There's another one, TK. I would really love to hear your thoughts on it. I hope you will eventually watch it, because this was a real surprise for me this year. I really did not expect it to be as good as it turned out to be. And the poster for this, I always thought it was very bland. There's this two, like 1-2 poster set where one angle is on Emmanuel Riva with Louis-Jean Trintignant holding her head, like cupping her head in his hands. And then the other one is like the reverse shot. And I always thought that was just kind of an odd poster and not overly compelling. But after you see the film, it's given a whole new context, and it actually becomes kind of fascinating, I thought.
I should say Emmanuel Riva almost deserves an Oscar for her willingness to do a nude scene at her age.
she was awesome in this movie.
Oh, amazing.
She really did blow me away. I think she does an absolutely fantastic job. So we're going to wrap up the podcast by giving our predictions for the winners in a bunch of the major categories. So let's go. I have them listed here. When I sent out our agenda for the night, I put them in an order, but I'm going to do them in reverse order of what I had listed there. So we'll start with Best Supporting Actress. Robin, who's going to win it?
I think it's going to be Anne Hathaway, mostly on the basis of her big solo number, which was terrific. Like, it maybe wasn't the best performance of the year, but looking at the other nominees, like, it really isn't a great field. And the fact that she's, like, a big star who's never won before, I think the Academy will give it to her.
TK, do you agree with that assessment?
Sadly, yes. I'm going to be giving a secondary choice whenever we go around. I want Amy Adams to win this really badly. And I really want her to win, but I think Hathaway is going to, which kind of disappoints me because I think Adams is a much stronger actress in The Master than Hathaway is in Les Mis.
I still haven't seen The Master, and I really need to. I really need to take care of that. I also haven't seen The Sessions, and I know that Helen Hunt has been getting a lot of praise for her role in it. TK, did you see The Sessions? Did you have time to watch that one?
No, it's one of the ones I'm watching this week in lead up, so.
I'm very curious about that because I've heard pretty universally good things about her performance in it. I need to see The Master. Jackie Weaver, I felt, was sort of a non-presence in Silver Linings Playbook, and I did not like Sally Field and Lincoln. So I, too, predict that Anne Hathaway will take it. I don't know. I'd almost like to see something come out of left field here and surprise us. Maybe Helen Hunt. But, yeah, I suspect. It seems like Anne Hathaway is a shoo-in at this point. Best Supporting Actor. TK, who's going to win Best Supporting Actor?
Hang on a second. Sorry, let me just double check here. I think De Niro's going to win this year.
You think De Niro's going to win? This was a tough one to pick because it's sort of like this who's who of sort of prestigious over 40 actors.
Everyone's won before.
Yeah, exactly.
All of them have Oscars, but I think De Niro's going to win it because of the attention Silver Linings has gotten. I would like Christoph Waltz to win again because
of course,
I think
dude's awesome. Give him every award. Robin, who do you think is going to take home Best Supporting Actor?
You know what? I am going to go ahead and pick Christoph Waltz because, like, I was thinking that they wouldn't give it to him because he already won it like 3 years ago. But I'm looking at the other nominees.
So is everybody. Like,
yeah, but I'm looking at the other nominees and there are no other real blowaway performances. And like you said, everyone else has won before, so it's not like they have any major story where they're giving it to like a first timer or something. And like the other performances are good, but aren't just real standouts. So I think they might give it to Christoph Waltz again just because he doesn't really have any major competition.
Well, I would gladly hand the award to Christoph Waltz. I'm actually going to – I mean, there's a lot of talk of Robert De Niro, but I'm actually going to throw in Tommy Lee Jones. I've heard a lot of praise for Tommy Lee Jones, particularly his performance in Lincoln. And so just to be a bit contrarian, but also because I think he does stand a chance, I'm going to say Tommy Lee Jones is going to take home Best Supporting Actor. So Best Screenplay, let's go for the Best Adapted Screenplay. Robin, you're a screenwriter. What do you think is going to win?
Oh, it definitely should be Argo because it took a true story, made it suspenseful, and like you said, it added tons of humor to it to make it interesting. Maybe Lincoln has an outside shot, but that's a movie that you said on paper is very dry and doesn't have a lot of humor. So I really hope that Argo wins, but I think it's definitely the best candidate. I think it's going to take it.
TK, what do you predict?
I want Argo to win. I actually think Lincoln's going to win because the book, I've flipped through the book that it's based off of, and holy fuck, good for you guys for adapting that into a watchable film. It's an impressive amount of work, and I think Lincoln's going to take it.
I am with Robin. I think Argo's going to take it. And sadly, I get a real feeling that Argo's going to win a few minor categories, the minor, quote unquote, but like Best Adapted Screenplay. And it's not going to get Best Picture in my thoughts anyway. But we'll get to that in a second. So what about Best Original Screenplay?
Well, as unlikely as it seemed that Quentin Tarantino would get nominated for Django Unchained, I actually think he's going to win for this one because it's been nearly 20 years since he won for Pulp Fiction, so they might give it to him as like a sympathy award. And none of the other nominees like really stand out. Like I know Zero Dark Thirty, Mark Bolio won for The Hurt Locker a couple years ago, so, and I don't see them giving it to Moonrise Kingdom or Flight or Amour, so I think it's going to be Tarantino, Django Unchained.
TK?
I actually came to the same conclusion Robin did for the same reasons.
You think it's going to be Django and Jane?
Yeah, but I think it's going to be Django. I really want Moonrise to win because I really like that movie. It's my I think it was my favorite movie last year, and I really want it to get a little more recognition than it's gotten.
I don't think it's going to be Django. Again, much as I'd love it to be, I actually think Moonrise Kingdom is going to take this one.
Oh.
And I think so simply because this is like the one category that Moonrise Kingdom has been nominated in. And this is another quote from Welcome to the Basement, but, you know, if the Academy doesn't go for Moonrise Kingdom, they're just never going to go for Wes Anderson in general. But I get this feeling like they're going to give it to Moonrise Kingdom, if only to give it that one award. But we'll see. Time will tell. Best Actress, guys. Robin, who do you think is going to take home Best Actress?
I'm going to stick with Jessica Chastain. I know in recent weeks a lot of the mileage has been going to Jennifer Lawrence, but I was still so impressed with her performance when I originally saw it that I think she's still going to win it. It's going to be this is the toughest category to call for acting because it's really a dead heat between the two of them, but I'll go with Chastain.
You know, Chastain is a good pick because she was in so many of the Oscar-nominated movies last year, but I don't think she won for any of them, did she? TK, who do you predict will win Best Actress?
I think Lawrence is going to win Best Actress. Yeah, because I really don't see any other one that's really huge standout for me, to be honest. I really think she's going to win, mostly because of the hype, and she's tucked away, I think, every other award this year, so for Best Actress category at the BAFTAs and the Globes, so that's my prediction.
I'm with you. Jennifer Lawrence is going to win, and in addition to all those reasons, I believe she was also snubbed for Winter's Bone, which I still think is her best performance to date, and I predict that this will not only be a win for her because she was quite good in Silver Linings Playbook, but also because the Academy will feel the need to apologize for having passed her up for a much better performance in a previous film. Okay, guys, I mean, Best Actor. Who's it going to be?
Yeah, it doesn't even matter how many other awards you've won in the past. Like, it's just so blatantly obvious here who's going to win this one.
Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis is going to win this. The joke, the honest movie poster for Lincoln was just called Daniel Day-Lewis Wants an Oscar.
Yeah.
I bet he's going to get that Oscar. The biggest surprise of this year's Oscars will be if they don't give it to Daniel Day-Lewis. I will be floored if they don't give it to him.
With that said, I really kind of want Phoenix to win for this because I really thought his performance in The Master was outstanding. I really did. So he's my hopeful. But, like, Lewis is going to sweep it anyway. But come on, Academy. Come on. Well, Lewis I think when he won the Globe, he actually said Phoenix should be up there. So I'm kind of, maybe, you know, maybe. Come on, guys, maybe.
I mean, I still haven't seen The Master, but I do love Joaquin Phoenix's acting. He's quite great. I feel like, though, he's probably really soured the Academy towards him after I'm Still Here. It seemed like that, like, that was a sort of, I hesitate even to call it a prank. It was like an experiment that just went nowhere. I mean, how many people even think of that movie anymore? Did I even get the title right? I keep on getting confused with, like, I'm Not There. It's I'm Still Here, right?
Yeah.
Does anybody even talk about that movie anymore? No. exactly. And I kind of feel like for that reason, Joaquin probably doesn't stand a chance. I mean, none of them stand a chance. Does anyone really expect Denzel to take it for Flight? I don't think so. Hugh Jackman for Les Mis, I mean, the guy certainly gave it his all, but I don't think he salvaged that movie. And, you know, Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings Playbook, really good performance, but come on, you're going up against Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, there's really no contest here, I don't think.
We'll see Day-Lewis again in 5 years, I'm sure. Yep. When he's in the mood for another Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. And I keep saying it, but if anybody is if any Hollywood producer is listening, somebody cast that guy in a superhero movie so he can actually learn to fly and then teach us all how to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Best director. Now, this is where things get really interesting because, of course, if your movie was not it was nominated for Best Picture but not Best Director, then it doesn't stand a great chance of winning Best Picture. So, so TK, who do you think is going to take it in Best Director?
Spielberg.
Yeah.
Hands down, I think Spielberg's going to take it. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Lincoln's got too much going for it. And like compared to the other ones, like Silver Lining is a good adaptation, but, I don't know, for directing Beasts of the Southern Wild, the movie can go fuck itself. I really didn't like that movie, guys. It's one of those films, like I said, with Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. What the fuck is it doing up there?
Oh, wow.
I got really mad at it. I don't think Ang Lee is going to go for Pi, but then again, I can't say it. Although I'm interested in just seeing him more because I'll have a better idea there. But as of right now, because I've only seen three of the films that are nommed, I vote Spielberg.
Robin, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Like, it just, yeah? Looking at the other nominees, that it just seems like Spielberg is like the runaway winner here. And he hasn't won since, I think, Saving Private Ryan. So I think the Academy might think that he's due to receive another one. But I would be mighty curious to see David O. Russell win, because he's got such a reputation for being an asshole. I would love to see him go up to the podium and give a speech and see what he would do.
I'm gonna go for the dark horse. I'm gonna say Ben Zeitlin is gonna win Beasts of Southern Wild, and I don't think he deserves it, but I'm just gonna say that too. But looking at these directors, you know, if I had my choice, obviously Tarantino is a nominated here. So if I were handing out the awards, I'd probably give it to Michael Haneke, because I felt like to direct a film like Amour was quite an undertaking, and that film, you know, it may drag at certain points, but boy, the attention to detail is really quite stunning. So that would get my vote. But look at Michael Haneke, Ang Lee, David O. Russell, Steven Spielberg. Only one of them really stands out as being sort of the gamble in a way. Ben Zeitlin, you know, this first time director for his first movie being nominated for Best Director. I feel like that is something that the Academy won't resist. It won't be able to resist passing up. For example, I'm going to make this comparison, and it's probably not a fair comparison. I feel like Kathryn Bigelow deserved to win Best Director, but I feel like the Academy awarded it to her because they would get the historical first woman to win Best Director media attention. I kind of feel like we might be seeing a similar case here, with Ben Zeitlin winning for Best Director for Beasts of the Southern Wild. I should also say that I don't think Amour is going to take Best Picture or Best Director, but it's a shoe-in for Best Foreign Film.
Yeah,
Hands down, it's going to take it.
When you're alone in a category as the only Best Picture nominee, the other ones don't stand a chance. It's the same thing with animated films. When they get a Best Picture nominee, you just know they're going to clean up in the Best Animated category.
Yeah, exactly. All right, and that brings us to the big one, Best Motion Picture of the Year. Robin, who do you think's going to win?
This was tough. I originally said Argo, but then I realized that it wasn't nominated for Best Director. It's got a lot of mileage in recent weeks, but I still think that Lincoln is going to bring home Best Picture because it's pure Oscar bait and it's nominated for a lot of other categories. And the thing with Argo is that I don't see it taking home many other awards except maybe in Best Adapted Screenplay. And it's like, is the Academy really going to do that? Give the Best Picture to a movie that barely wins any other awards that year? I just can't see it happening. So, yeah, I'm still going to pick Lincoln.
TK, do you agree with him?
Yeah, I still like, really? I think Lincoln's going to take it, but I really want Argo to win. Like,
fascinating. I thought you guys would both stick with Argo. It's certainly based off of just what we've been seeing in other award ceremonies. Argo has really been cleaning up, and at this point, I would almost call it a shoe-in. I was deliberately going to vote against you and say Beasts of the Southern Wild, just to go hand-in-hand with the Best Director. I don't know. I'm saying that because purely for political reasons. If I was going based on the quality and content of a movie, it would be between Argo and Lincoln, because both of them are very Oscar baity, and I probably would end up coming down the side of Argo just because it's won so many awards already. My initial thought was Zero Dark Thirty. It's not going to happen. They didn't nominate Catherine Bigelow. Likewise, Django Unchained, they didn't nominate Quentin. So my prediction is going to be Beasts of the Southern Wild. However, I am going to say that I think there might still be a chance that Life of Pi will take it. No, I'm kidding. I say Beasts of the Southern Wild, but the runner-up for me is Argo. But you know what? When the nominations were first announced and Amore was included here, I brushed it off. Now I totally see it. I feel like it fits alongside all these other films. It is a really made movie. I want to emphasize that again. But yeah, it's going to be Beasts of the Southern Wild. Just you wait, guys. I'm going to make you eat your words.
Well, we don't. When we make our picks, we don't go by regular logic. We just go by Academy logic. So that's where a lot of our choices come from.
It's all Academy logic. It really is. No, it has nothing to do with deserving. There's always the chance that they'll give it to someone just to apologize for a previous snub. Oh, you know, we didn't give Best Picture to War Horse, so we got to give it to Lincoln.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah, really. Any final thoughts or predictions about the Academy Awards this year? I'm really excited to watch the ceremony and do our Academy Awards wrap-up on our next episode, because that'll be a lot of fun. We can also list off some of the films and actors that we feel were really snubbed and maybe deserved nominations. We could do our version of the Oscars, where if we got to pick from the films this year, who would be nominated. But any other thoughts before the Oscars happen?
Not really, but I will have some choices for snubs next week that I thought really should have been nominated this year.
I'm kind of darkly excited to see what glaring omissions they will have in their memorial reel of people who died this year.
Oh, yes.
Every year there's some huge omission where they don't mention someone. I'm just like, you mentioned five people I've never heard of, but you didn't mention Dan O'Bannon. What's wrong with you?
They got to mention the publicist that no one's heard of.
Oh, my God. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm kind of darkly interested to see who sadly gets left off. It's almost like a mark of prestige now if you get left off the Oscar list. Well, with that, I think it's time for the dumb joke of the week. You know, I opened up my thesaurus today, and all the pages were blank. I have no words to describe how pissed off I am.
Oh,
oh my God.
Even you had to groan at that one.
Yeah, it's a bad one. It's a bad one. I've got one that TK told me a while back. I'm saving it for a particularly awful dumb joke of the week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so by email. Contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com, and be sure to peek behind the velvet rope for the steamy side of the back row. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com, and be sure to check out Robin's regular features, Robin's Underrated Gems and Before They Were Stars. And I write every day on the back row. You can email me at gil@the-back-row.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you after the Oscars.